Welcome to the latest episode of Aerospace Radio Station Extended.
I think somebody described the Phantom book as an episode of men behaving badly, and I think that's why it got quite a bit of following. But this one's a bit more stark, I think. When you do become a flying instructor, you have to mature. Otherwise, you know, you just pass on loads of bad habits to your students. So there's pressure on you to be better and role model all of that good behaviour. So hopefully people see a bit of that. Teaching air combat and low level, what better job could you have as an instructor?
Welcome to Extended, your aerospace radio station.
Chuck Wilson for the third time. Welcome to Extended, how are you?
I'm great, though. You must be sick of the sight of me now, are you, after three goes?
No, we wouldn't have had you back if we were. This is like a hat trick, isn't it? I don't know what we do. You get to keep the microphone or something, I think.
Oh, is that it? Is that what it is? Yeah. Okay.
Firstly, many congratulations. Your second book, Confessions of a Flying Instructor, is out now. It's been released by Font Hill. Big thanks to them, Jay, who got the text across to me so I could make sure I'd given it a proper read before this. But, Tug, well done. It's a superb read.
Thanks very much. We were just talking earlier, weren't we? I described this as my difficult second album. You never know. There's a bit of a novelty when you first write your first book, I think. All your mates buy it because they've got a bit of curiosity as to whether they're in it or not. whereas this one is a continuation, you know, it is showing hopefully how I've changed as an aviator and a person. It's not quite as in your face outrageous as the first book. So I'm hoping people see I'm on that journey where when you do become a flying instructor, you have to mature. Otherwise, you know, you just pass on loads of bad habits to your students. So there's pressure on you to be better and role model all of that good behavior. So hopefully people see a bit of that.
Yeah. A very different job, which we will come on to. Just on writing it, I mean, the Confessions of Phantom Pilot felt like it had just fallen out onto the page. Was this one, I mean, this one is the same, but was it, I don't know, I've never really asked you actually, did you find it easy to write the first one, and was this as easy, or?
You make it sound like I've vomited it out.
No, you don't.
so my day job is I teach human factors to all young aircrew coming into the Air Force, the Army, and the Navy. One of the ways we teach that is through storytelling. So I've been telling these stories for years and years, and I just figured it might be worth shoving them down on paper and see if anybody's dim enough to pick them up and publish them. And thank God Font Hill did that for me.
Enough to read it, yeah?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. keep buying them, Gareth. Keeping me in clothing, yeah. Once you think, I think I might do this, all you have to do is pull out your logbook, and there's the chronological sequence of it, and all you do is just slot all of those stories into the chronology that you see in front of you. That's how I've done these two books, and it seems to have worked. Some of the social stories might be slightly out of order, but you know, who cares really? All the important stuff is in the right order.
Okay, so we pick up essentially where we left off. It's May 1992. You have gone from Wattisham in Suffolk to Brodie in South Wales. The first thing that surprised me, but I realised why very quickly, you weren't there for the end of The Phantom, were you? And I had images of you being the last man standing at all, all of those parties, etc. I'm just interested. Maybe you could just explain to our listeners why you weren't there. And there was a good reason for that, wasn't there? Because there was a slot. Is that something you regret as well? I just wondered.
So when you talk about last man standing, I think at those end of Phantom parties, nobody was left standing. So to tell you the truth, it probably would have taken years off my life if I'd have if I'd have been there. Yeah, so as the Phantom was coming to a close, the writing on the wall was that all of us that were going to go to another flying tour were probably going to take a couple of years paying as sim instructors first. So not flying at all, and then go across to the Tornado F3, and I still had a lot of frontline rage in me, you know, and I wanted to fly, and so I looked at alternatives, and I just went to see the boss one day and said, "What do you think about TAC weapons instructor?" You know, and the other thing was in the background, lots of exchanges were going from the TAC weapons slots. So there was a bit of method in my madness there. And basically I solved a problem for the poster. You know, it was one less pilot that he didn't have to give bad news to. There was one tactics instructor slot left at Brodie. It was going to be the very last one. And that was that. I got recommended by the boss who did me a great favor, and off I went. Yeah. And I missed the last maybe 3-4 months of the Phantom. At the time, I had just under 700 hours on the Phantom, and everybody wants to get a 1,000-hour badge. You know, it's quite a big deal. Yeah. In 3 to 4 months, I wasn't going to pick up enough for that. So there was no Phantom reason to stay, if you see what I mean. And and I was already quite upset about the thing going out of service, and maybe there was a little bit of I don't want to see it finally die. You know, and. But it was a great opportunity to get the tactics instructor slot out of Brodie. So grabbed it with both hands, and you know the rest is history from there.
What were your expectations? Did you have any expectations, or did you kind of just, you know, like you say, there was a little bit of method in your madness. You're going to still be flying, which is going to be better than being in a sim for 2 years, that's for sure. And I guess you figured there might be an opportunity that would come out of that at the end. Which we'll touch on later on, but what were you expecting when you pitched up at Brodie?
I think I was expecting to join the squadron that I was going to be doing my staff training on to become an instructor. I expected I was just going to slot into that squadron as if I'd just come off my old squadron, you know, and I'd had 3 years of very, very close-knit squadron camaraderie, and I figured that would be the same thing. And bearing in mind, the instructors that I'm about to go flying with, who are going to assess me and teach me to be an instructor, I'm going to be working alongside them, you know, when we eventually move to Valley, which was always the plan. So I figured my expectation was turn up. It was going to be hard work, but as flying always is, but I thought it'd be a bit more fun than it actually was doing the staff course and the staff workup. It wasn't quite the rah 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 and rally around the flag boys sort of environment at Brodie. It certainly was when I got to Valley, but you know that was 4 or 5 months after that. When you go to be a tactics instructor, you basically do an abridged version of the TAC weapons course that all the students do. And when I say abridged, it's not massively abridged. So I did the TAC weapons course again, and you know I didn't have great memories of doing it as a student. So having opened myself up for that again, I knew it was going to be a great job. It really was. You know, teaching air combat and low level. What better job could you have as an instructor?
Can you just remind some of us, or tell some people for the first time if they haven't read Phantom, what you thought of TAC weapons when you went through it as a student?
Oh dear God, it was a horror story. It really was. I describe it as I think I describe it as a bloodbath in parts. It probably wasn't as bad as that. And as human beings, we tend to always anchor on the bad things that happen because they make the best stories. But I had an unpleasant experience, let's say, at Tac Weapons. Came out of it with a few scars, and I still have this. Everybody finds it amazing that I can hold a grudge for forever, you know. And I got treated badly by a couple of qualified weapons instructors. So from then on, I loathe QIs. You know, I've met some brilliant guys who have been QIs at the front line, but those three or four at Tac Weapons just soured me for the rest of my life. So that was my experience as a student, and then it was a lot better doing it as a pre-course to becoming an instructor at when I was at Brodie. So yeah, but there were still some tough trips on there. You know, I spent 3 full years just doing air defence, intercepts, air combat, down at low level as well. But I'd never, I wasn't that great at ground attack when I was a student. And, you know, I'm staring at possibly teaching this very, very shortly afterwards. So there was a bit of pressure on those trips.
And how did you feel about the teaching part, Tug? What did frontline rage phantom pilot Tug think he was going to be like as an instructor, as a teacher?
Yeah, I'll be honest, I was really looking forward to it. Again, I thought the job was going to be really good. And as a tactics instructor, you're not just teaching the exercises. You're teaching a bit of personality, a bit of charisma and panache and a bit of aggression and such. And that fitted quite well with how I thought I'd done at the front line. But I was really looking forward to, you know, mentoring, coaching, whatever we want to call it. So I didn't go in. I was a volunteer to be an instructor, and a lot of people get sent instructor or used to get sent instructor, and they'd not volunteered for it, so they had a little bit of attitude with it. I was just pretty open to it. I thought it was going to be a good job, and it was. It was awesome.
Now there's another huge personality in this book that we need to talk about. In Phantom, there was kind of you, the Phantom itself, and all your colleagues, and you and your colleagues are still in this. But, well, blow me down if you didn't fall in love with another woman in this book, which is the Hawk T1, isn't it? Because anyone who's read your first book will know what you think of and still think of the F4 Phantom. But correct me if I'm wrong, that little Hawk came, I mean, it's different, but it came pretty close, didn't it?
It did, and I don't know anybody who's flown the Hawk that doesn't adore it, you know. And why wouldn't you? It's a tiny little thing, you know. It's very compared to the big old boiler of a aeroplane I fell in love with at the front line. This was really sleek, and I think I describe it as it's the girl that your mother warned you about, you know, when it got airborne. And it really turned my head, as it turned everybody's head, I think. And it was slippery fast. It never went wrong. And it was just completely eager to please you. You could abuse this thing like you read about, and it wouldn't depart or spin or anything like that. You really had to be horribly ham-fisted to make it go wrong. So, why wouldn't you just fall in love with that? And actually, sometimes flying, military flying, it's such hard work, and it can be a little bit tedious at times. You know, it's a job after all. When you got back into the Hawk, it reminded you that you truly did love flying again. You know, there was a joy to get an airborne because you weren't strapping in thinking, oh God, I wonder what's going to go wrong today, you know, with this thing. like I said, I always used to say the Phantom always looked like some incontinent pensioner, you know. It was always leaking over the pan or something. And you did wonder, you know, is everything going to work today? What's it going to be like? And there was no worries like that with the Hawk. That was why it's just such a beauty, you know.
So that What did they get so right that made it, and well, still made it, it's still used, you know, across the globe today. You mentioned that sort of forgiveness, the fact that you know, people could get away with being, is that kind of at the heart of what's made it such an incredible training platform? I mean, God knows how many people have flown Hawk as part of their military training across the globe. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, and like you're saying, they're still doing it. I think for us, it replaced the Nat and the Hunter in training, both of which took an immense amount of skill to fly. I think the Nat was, I think it was horrible to fly from what I've heard. You really had to be on your game. And then, of course, people got their wings on the Nat. They go to attack weapons course, and they'd have to learn a brand new aeroplane. You know, they go on to the Hunter. I mean, proper single-seat Hunters as well. I'd love to have flown that, but I wouldn't have relished learning a whole new aeroplane to then do attack weapons course. So the fact that the Hawk carried across to both makes it easier for us. It is very, very benign. If you look at some of the chimp finger baboons that we've got flying aeroplanes, including me, and it never once flicked on me or did something stupid. I don't know, whoever designed that aeroplane, you know, whoever was responsible for that should be they should be living in clover for the rest of their lives, because it's I can't say anything bad against it, Gareth. I just can't think of anything I didn't like about it.
It's still number two, though, right?
Oh, of course it is. Yeah, yeah. Never forget your first girlfriend, even though she's probably either forgotten you or having nightmares about you. But yeah, still number two.
So, as you've explained, you turn up at Broadie to be an instructor, but the first thing you have to do is become a student again.
Yeah.
So, how did you find that?
Yeah, it was. I knuckled down. I made a choice to. I'd got married at the end of the Phantom. My wife wasn't with me; she was still teaching at a primary school in Germany. But I made a choice to take a quarter rather than go in the mess, and so it was easy then for me to knuckle down and do all my learning in the evening. I had a really boring life, I've got to tell you. All I did was fly, and then prep for flying in the evenings.
Did you fly as well? You flew so much in this book. You actually mention a couple of times how many trips you sort of had in a period of a month or whatever it was. And my God, you were flying relentlessly.
Shocking. It was shocking. I was 2-3 times a day. I think my first month at Broadie, so as a student, I think I flew 36 times in that month. So I was going home, prepping a bit of food and throwing that down, prepping for the sorties the next day, because, and here's the deal, I've never been able to rest on my laurels. I've always had to prep for sorties, and bearing in mind I'm now a student again and I'm being assessed on every trip, then I just went back into student mode, prep, and up at 6 in the morning, driving to Broadie, 3 trips, 3 debriefs, prep for the 2 trips the next day or whatever it was I had the following Monday. So yeah, it was relentless, babe. But what else? I had nothing else to do with my life at that time. I might as well have just been flying and talking about it, you know.
There's a lovely consistent thread in that part of the book, which immediately made me think of the OCU in Confessions 1, where you've got this mixture of guys that you loved to fly with, and you felt those trips were incredibly productive.
Yeah,
but then there's a flip side to that as well, isn't there, with some of the other people who you were flying with?
Life's like that, isn't it? You know, you come across great people, and there's plenty of arseholes out there as well. And on a squadron, you would generally in the RAF, you would expect 95% great guys and just one anomaly, you know. But because this wasn't a squadron, it was a training squadron where people have been brought in from other aeroplanes and fleets, then you might just be unlucky and get the arsehole from each fleet. But don't get me wrong, I flew with some great guys, some superstars, and the ones that I really got the most out of, even though I was a student in inverted commas being taught or assessed, a couple of them started telling me, hey, look, when you teach this, this is the kind of thing you need to look for. This is the kind of thing you need to look at. I learned so much from those guys. And then I flew with other guys who treated me like I was a student going through tac weapons for the first time. And all I did, all you do is you put on a different coat, Gareth, and you go, well, they want me to be Joe student. That's what I'll be then, you know. Yeah. But when you get back down in the crew room, don't expect to be bantering me or telling me all about, you know, the last trip you did in a Jaguar and how great it was, because I'm not interested, mate. You've treated me like I'm a student, so that's what you're going to get from me. As you can see, and I think it runs through that first bit of the book, I'm a bit of a bolshy git at some points, because I'm used to being on an integral part of a band of brothers, and yeah. And I can't stand people who don't sign up to that. You know, I'm on the squadron. I know I'm a student, but I'm wearing the squadron colours. Come on, I'm going to be an instructor with you in 4 months' time. Let's have, you know, a bit of a different relationship in the cockpit. It was the bloody QIs again. It's always the weapons instructors.
Same ones.
Yeah.
Was that maybe the hardest thing to adapt to, and if you like, the life on the ground, away from the actual flying, that rapport and that band of brothers? Because you've gone from this incredible situation, haven't you? And I know it's a bit different when you got to Wattisham. It certainly wasn't the same as being in Germany.
Yeah.
But still, but you've taken another sort of step away from that here, haven't you?
Yeah. So Germany was everything. You know, it was everything. Wattisham was still great, but not as great. And now I'm removed, because I went as a singleton. It was just me that went to Broadie with none of my mates around me. I had that kind of little feeling of isolation, and it just takes a different mindset. But that was a bit difficult to transition to. And but you know, here we are. I managed to do that. Like I said, met some great guys who I then ended up instructing alongside up at Valley, and all the people that I didn't get along with, they faded out and left the Air Force, and very shortly after Broadie closed, because they didn't want to move to Valley, and yeah, never saw them again. And that's just how service life goes. Yeah,
let's take a skip forward. Your first students, tell us a bit of what it was like the first time you've got a proper student in the aircraft. It's you and somebody who really needs to pass that trip.
Yeah.
They're on.
Do you know the bizarre thing is, Gareth, he contacted me on LinkedIn last week. So my very first student.
No way. That's amazing.
Yeah. He bought the book, and then he sent me a message saying,
brilliant.
Hey, I'm guessing I was such and such, you know, and the bizarre thing was I flew with him, and he said, it was Air Combat Maneuvering 2, which is a pretty miserable trip. In ACM 1, you're the aggressor. Everything happens out the front of the aeroplane, and it is the sport of kings. You just put the gun sight on, you pull the trigger, and set it all up again, and it's brilliant. ACM 2 is defensive ACM. It's not so pleasant, because you're looking over your shoulder at 6G nearly all the time, trying to defend against people. So what we look for on that trip is, first off, don't give up. You know, just turn yourself inside out. Even when the bullets are hitting you, keep maneuvering that aeroplane and don't give up. And the other thing is, don't fly through the simulated base height. So for students, we would set a base height of 10,000 feet for air combat. If it was staff, we were at 5,000 feet. I said the Hawk's quite benign. You can still screw up spectacularly, because it's really fast, and it's like a little lawn dart if you're going, you know, ultra fast. So we'd have this artificial base height of 10,000 feet, ground level of 10,000 feet. So all we're looking for is, don't go through that, don't give up, then you'll be safe to go off and fly solo, because it's the solo check. So I flew with him, and I was really looking forward to it, you know, flying with my first student. I think I must have briefed him to death, the poor kid, you know, because I wanted to make sure I got everything out there. There's a lot of demonstration on that trip as well, so I needed to get all my demos right. And then he was okay. He wasn't great. He was okay. And we used to score from 0 to 5. 0 and 1 were fails. 2, you just kind of scraped your sorry ass across the razor blade and got a pass. 3 was average, and then it was 4s and 5s. And I gave him a 2. On my very first instructional sortie, I gave him a 2, and I'm sure everybody's thinking, God bloody hell, you know, tug the bastard straight away, you know, making a name for himself. Well, he contacted me on LinkedIn, and he said, my record, he said, I've been telling everybody that I was your first ever student tug, and you gave me a 4. So I just wrote back to him. I said, oh, let's go with that then, you know, it makes me look a lot better. I'm convinced it was a 2, though.
Can you just talk to us a little bit about, I think people are quite interested in this, about capacity and a human's ability to keep taking information in and processing that information and acting upon it, and how it's obviously relevant to this conversation, in the cockpit of a fast jet, how people can reach a level, can't they, where they simply cannot process any more information. And I guess what's interesting is these students that you're with at Tac Weapons, they've all got their wings, they've all gone through flying training, they can all fly.
Yeah.
But people can still fail here, can't they? This is, passing Tac Weapons is not, by any stretch of the imagination, a foregone conclusion.
No, it's not. And it is heartbreaking, because they're so close to getting to an OCU for a big proper jet. So one of the things that we're constantly assessing is capacity. So most people everybody can do the up, down, left, right, fast, slow thing of flying an aeroplane. What we're now doing is we're in inverted commas, operating an aeroplane. That's what everybody calls it. But in order to do that, you need something a bit more than just handling skills. You need much more processing skills in your brain too. If we look at something as simple as a 1v1 air combat trip, which is, you know, quite canned at the start with set maneuvers, still got to recognize the point where you're going to fly through, and therefore you have to stop that. You still got to handle the aeroplane aggressively, not handling it like you would a normal aeroplane now, but aggressively point it where you want to go, manage the energy using the throttle. You know, you can stick it in the loud corner all you like, but if you get up to 500 knots, you come into a fight like that, everybody just turns inside you and shoots you down, you know. So there's a lot more thought goes into it. There's like a chess match in your head against the person you're fighting against. When you do intercepts, you have to build a picture in your mind of where that aeroplane is. It's 40 miles away, but you have to build a picture of what it's doing, what heading do you think it's going to go, and if there's 2 aeroplanes out there, you know, what formation are they in? So actually people tend to fail at those late stages on capacity and lack of mental performance rather than pure handling. And, you know, I've seen myself, although you take somebody like me who, and there were plenty like me through training, who we could handle an aeroplane, we just weren't very good at doing it. You know, we weren't as accurate as the next man or as smooth or anything like that. But then we start flying air combat. Smooth doesn't win the fight. Sheer bloody mindedness sometimes wins the fight, and a bit of cheating as well, which I was more than happy to do when I was a student.
Yeah, there's a bit of that in the book.
Yeah,
as well.
and as an instructor as well. Yeah, yeah. I always win the first fight. That's the deal. So yes, you can get chopped at that late stage, and people did. And to my, I wouldn't say shame, but to my upset, I chopped 2 people as well. And you're taking their dream away from them, but there's a reason you're doing that. What you've probably done is save their lives. They could handle the aeroplane. They could both handle the aeroplane, but they couldn't do the other things outside of it because they'd reached their capacity limit. And it's sad, but that's what happens to some people, you know.
There's some fascinating bits in there where you talk about your frustration, if you like, with some of the students. You feel like you know they can do it, you know, but they just can't seem to put it all together when they need to. And some people just, I mean, you can't. I don't know. Can you train capacity? Can you increase somebody's capacity, or you know, other? But your frustration at times comes through in the book, and I guess it's because of, you know, what's going to happen. There is only there's only one end result of that, isn't there?
Yeah. So, I mean, I always say that I don't even have been a student myself 4 years prior to that when I first started instructing. So I think I had empathy with them, having struggled a little bit myself at various points. But when you know somebody has the ability to do something and it's capacity limiting, there are ways of training capacity. It's what I do now for a living. We help to free up spare mental capacity for students. Well, those days, there wasn't a formal course that taught this stuff, but there were ways that you could do preparing properly. Gareth, we do armchair flying all the time. If you don't do enough prep, you get caught out. You know, there's a clear link between lack of prep and lack of performance when it comes to military aviation, I think. So when you get a student who can do all the manoeuvres but can't put them together and manage a sortie, I think that's quite an easy thing to solve. You can talk through how you would manage a particular sortie. You talk through the what ifs. What will we do if this happens? Now, it may not happen, but we've got a plan if it does. And it's almost like we plan to be flexible. And flexibility comes from that pre-planning. So there is a way of training that sort of thing. However, everything that you do, it all goes to ratchet sometimes. When you do something wrong in the air and you know you've done something wrong, it's like on a driving test. You know, you do something wrong on the driving test and you think, oh, God, that's me failed then. And therefore, you're not applying yourself properly to everything else. Now, in a trip like anything that we did, there are very few things where you make one mistake and that will be a fail. So there's a bit of resilience that needs to be taught or helped with us as well. It's just a big jigsaw puzzle, Gareth, all of these big bits. So you can free up a bit of capacity by prepping properly. You can talk through techniques for resilience. There's the handling side of things. In various things like air combat, there's the aggression side of things. There's thinking through what your game plan is going to be beforehand for that first fight or the second fight. And there's all sorts of things that students can do to help themselves, which I had to do as a student. And I think that was where sometimes I got a bit frustrated. If there was a student who was acing the course and didn't put the effort in, that used to really grip me. I hated that because I never had that luxury. If it was a student who was just trying but was a bit crap, but they were trying their hardest, I loved them, absolutely loved them, and tried my best to do it. You go through this period as an instructor, I think, where for the first 6 months, I think I was all right but not very good. For 18 months, I was at the top of my game. And then the last 6 months, I'm just full of frustration because no matter how much I pre-brief them and try to help them, they still make those mistakes. And you forget now, because it's now nearly 6 years since I was a student, that I forget that I was doing exactly that as a student. Yeah. So I think most instructors go through that kind of progression.
Did you know that during the Falklands War in 1982, there was a plan to put the Black Buck raids on steroids by sending an Avro Vulcan to bomb airfield targets on mainland Argentina, potentially returning to RAF Waddington the long way round via Chile, Easter Island, Tahiti, Hawaii, the USA and Canada? Did you also know that during the Second World War, a proposal was made to build B-29 superfortresses in the UK, powered by Bristol Centaurus engines? If your answers to the above are yes, you're probably a regular reader of The Aviation Historian, the quarterly journal, print and digital, that explores the less well-trodden paths of flying history. if your answers are no, visit theaviationhistorian.com and see what you're missing.
There's a section where about a student who you say has got GR1 written all over him.
Yeah.
Now, shout out to Mike Napier, by the way.
Yes, yeah.
Now, at this point, of course, in the early 90s, you've got what I guess would have been considered, sorry, to be the coveted single seat slots of Jaguar and Harrier.
Yeah.
And then there's Tornado GR1 and Tornado F3. Obviously, it's completely different now. Obviously, everything is single seat.
Yeah.
Everything is single seat. It's funny the way it's kind of come round. Is it possible to kind of define what is the difference between somebody who at the end of Tac Weapons, you're going to sit down and think, well, actually, they can go Jaguar or Harrier, as opposed to somebody who might be better off with somebody sitting behind them?
Coming back to Mike Napier, who's saying they've got GR1 written all over them. They were the dull, uninteresting people in the crew room. And I know we went through this when we had happy hour with Mike that time, but given that he's not here, I thought it was worth another dig. Yeah, you can. And do you know what, Gareth? It's not the handling thing. It's the capacity thing that is the difference between the those that we look – coming out at the end of Tac Weapons, most students, I think, would have been able to have a go at flying Jaguar, I would think, single-seat Jaguar. Harrier was, I think, a slightly different concept just because it – I know we rail on Harrier pilots, and rightly so, but that was an incredibly difficult aeroplane to fly in the first place and then operate as well. So all of the joking aside from Harrier pilots, I say joking, we absolutely truly believed all the stuff we said about them, but there was something just a little bit special about the students that went to the Harrier. As I said, those that had GR1 written all over them probably could have had a bit of a good go at doing the Jag, but why would you put them in that position where they might struggle when they could be absolutely outstanding twin seat operators?
Because of course, failing an OCU is not completely unheard of either, is it?
No, it isn't. I mean, God, no.
That must be like the worst of the worst.
Yeah, so close. Yeah, I mean, we had a pilot failed. My Phantom OCU failed on my course. There was a pilot on the junior course failed the Phantom OCU. I mean, that's just horrible to get that far. The bizarre thing was the guy who failed the Phantom OCU went back through the system after him flown the Hawk for 2 years. They sent him Jags. Right. After that, and he failed that OCU, so he ended up on GR1s in the end. But you just thought, God, you could have sorted that out, a bit better Air Force. So, it was the capacity thing that set aside those folks. Now, those that there was a difference for those that were going to go air defence. There was a complete difference in the psyche of those students. And we recognised that there was a real phantom mafia among the instructors. There were about four of us, I think, and you could spot the people who were best suited to go in air defence straight away in a heartbeat. There was something about them. We shared a crew room with them, and they took a shot at the title every day. You know, they try and banter the instructors every day.
One particular student who features quite heavily, who has no qualms at all, does he? Just doesn't care. You know, he's trying to banter off, regardless of how good he's been or not. He's going to get his little digs in.
I don't know whether he thought he was going to get chopped on every single trip, so he might as well go down in a nuclear firestorm every
Blaze
day.
Of glory.
You know, yeah, exactly. Yeah. So he'd take a shot most days. And you know, our banter was honed at the front line. It was nuclear standard. So he got machine gunned every day. But he got up like a punch drunk boxer again, you know, and had another go. We loved him for it. But he was definitely going to go Tornado F3. He was going to go air defence, you know. So we you could just spot a bit of attitude and personality in your students as well.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because these cadres of pilots from these particular, or aircrew rather, not just pilots, from these particular, each type, they are quite defined, aren't they? That they become, you know, again, you mentioned about the Harrier, the Harrier pilots and everything, but these are communities, aren't they, that are kind of, they're clearly, something must be right, because they're the same kind of breed of man and woman now,
yeah,
in particular,
yeah.
Is going to the same aircraft.
We were mostly a really good fit with each other. There were only the odd anomaly on the Phantom who shouldn't have been there, as far as I could tell. You know, and I don't mean on their flying ability or anything like that. I mean purely on their personality. There were just a couple that didn't fit out of all of the Phantom people that I came across. So, you know, somehow the selection process must be about right. And GR people have a very definite look about them and attitude about them. When, you know, when we had that happy hour with Mike, if you look at us, we actually underlying we're all the same. When it comes to it, we've all shared the same scars through training and what, and we have a brotherhood and an empathy with each other about that. But once we take the fork and I go air defence and he went ground attack, we became completely different from each other. Yeah. And I think that's a good thing. You know, I think it breeds a bit of banter between the various fleets, which is always healthy. But there was always a healthy respect as well, I think, between the fleets. And as I said, we railed and railed on the Harrier guys for what they were like and always trying to be better than each other. And, you know, that just didn't come into our psyche. But maybe that's exactly what they needed to operate that aeroplane in the way that they did it.
Let's talk a little bit about what you're actually doing. You touched upon this a little bit about 20 minutes ago or so. You're a fighter pilot. You're an air combat man. The sport of kings. This is where you've come from. With the F4, you know, the intercepts, you know, the dogfighting. You're not an air to ground. You're not a bomber pilot, essentially. Let's talk about the ACM a little bit first, because you became rather good at it in the Hawk. That becomes quite clear in the book. But you had to work at it, didn't you? So the Hawk is not the Phantom. This is, that sounds really obvious, but the way that you physically fight the Hawk, you kind of had to learn how to do that, didn't you?
Yeah, you do. God, you know, when you said that, it made me sound like, and that's not me saying it, by the way, but it obviously comes across in the book like I'm some kind of air combat god, you know. But
I wouldn't say that, but...
Jeez, okay, all right. You're breaking up, Gareth. I think we're losing the link, are we? Hopefully, people will see in the book that there is a progression in me. Whereas I didn't rate myself at all up to this point. Now I'm becoming an instructor and teaching this stuff. I have to be good at it in order to teach it properly. So, and we used to do a lot of staff 1v1 combat where, you know, no students would just fly against each other. My God, you could hone your skills and you'd try all sorts of different things that you couldn't try with the students. And you explored the envelope. And because the Hawk is so benign, the envelope's massive, you know, and you could fly all day and not find yourself outside of it. So I think I did get pretty handy at it. And there's a number of tricks that you can pull in all aeroplanes as far as air combat goes. And when you can only ever use them once, because people then go, oh, you know, you're not allowed to do that. Well, it's within the rules, mate, you know. And the reason it's worked is because you're not sharp enough to see that this is 1v1 combat, okay? It's not real. This stuff doesn't really happen for real anymore. This is purely a game. And it's a game where if I'm leading the sortie, the pair, it's my game you're playing, and therefore I've got all of the advantages. So you can whine about it as much as you like. So yesterday when you were leading the trip. Why the hell didn't you do what I just did? Well, I didn't know you could.
There's a couple of great bits where you sort of pull out some tricks from the Phantom copybook that you'd, you know, just to use on people, which I absolutely loved.
Yeah, I think, is that the intercept trip? I think it was, yeah. I mean, that was a bit of a ballsy move, to tell you the truth. I was in standards. So every 6 months we had to go and fly with all the standards pilots to make sure that we taught things properly. And there was a really good program of standardization. We're teaching fairly dynamic exercises. There is a bit of leeway in there, but there are certain things that you need to do. So I was doing a 2v2 intercept into combat trip and leading it. Me and three other standards pilots. So, you know, they're stacking up to assess me here. And I just cheated. We came in below the base height during the intercepts, which is absolutely within the rules. We'd got the ground controllers. I kind of bribed them to give false information to the other pair. And it was all a bit of a hoot, you know. And my wingman, although he was assessing me, said, yeah, okay, it'll be a valuable lesson for those two if they get caught out. And they did get caught out, but you can only pull that sort of stuff once, you know, in the tour. But, God, it was worth it. The look on their faces was absolutely worth it, yeah.
Brilliant. So the fact that you went to the Phantom and became Tug Wilson, the air defence pilot, obviously tells us a bit about your own experiences as a student at TAC Weapons.
Yeah.
So you now have to come back. And you have to. You can't only instruct people in air defence. You have to do the whole syllabus. So, what was it like going back to the air to ground portion of that, revisiting it, and then obviously teaching people to do it?
Yeah, I won't. I won't lie. It's the one bit when I was driving to Broadie, I was just thinking, oh God, you know, what have I let myself in for or here? You know, look, I could do ground attack well enough to pass the course when I was a student. I'd play up to the fact that I was rubbish at it. I was less rubbish at air defence than I was at ground attack. That's how I ended up going air defence. I think my final simulated attack profile mission, SAP, they were called, as a student, we have a time on target, you know, so fly out into the area. We had to go high to low to avoid weather, and we have the first target is a time on target. There's no kit; it's all stopwatch, map, and compass. I think I set a record. I was 32 minutes late for my time on target, but somehow still managed to pass the course. We were fighting all sorts of weather to try and get in, and it was just a nightmare. Got delayed and such. So I wasn't looking forward to even doing ground attack again. I'd flown low level a lot in the Phantom in Germany. We lived at low level, so I had no problem flying low level. But you know, navigating to the accuracy that's required to put a simulated bomb on target and do the dive attack properly with all the sighting was hard work. And I don't mind saying I had to work hard at it. I had to do a lot of route study. Still made, you know, plenty of mistakes as a staff student as such. When we do target runs, we plan them on a 50, one in 50,000 map, you know, like hikers use. So it's got all the relief on it and the roads and power lines and such like that. So the way we find a target is the target is usually generally small. So we look for a big feature, and it's called an IP, an initial point. And we plan the route from the initial point straight line to the target. And it takes about, yeah, it'll be between a minute and a half normally. And you thumb your way up this map. And it's all quite intense. And I used to pick the biggest bloody IPs that I could, you know, and I picked one. It was a castle on a hill, and I still managed to bloody miss it, you know. And I just thought, oh my God, you know, if I can't do this myself, how the hell am I going to teach it? But then it's just getting used to it, you know. It's getting back into the deal of flying those sorties, just like, say, the Tornado GR1 guys who came back as tactics instructors. They'd not flown air combat really for probably 3 years. So It was just about getting back into the swing of things. I stand by, though, that even towards the at the end of my time as an instructor, I could teach simulated attack, bounced simulated attack, where we've got a fighter attacking us while we're leading the pair out to our targets. I could adjust for a time on target. I could do all of that stuff, and I could teach it. However, the GR1 guys, the JAG guys, and the Harrier guys, they did it with such ease that it was a beautiful thing to see. And I hope when they saw me teaching intercepts or doing intercepts and air combat, that they saw a similar thing in me. There were some absolute superstars, ground attack instructors, and not all of them were JAG and Harrier guys. A lot of the Tornado GR1 boys, they are the best ground attack instructors I've ever seen.
Strikes me that anyone coming out of this at the other end, having been attack weapons instructor, you have to be incredibly well-rounded military pilot, fast jet pilot at this point. Probably, yeah, that the opportunity that gives you, and we'll talk a little bit about what came next, but you're kind of getting exposure to everything, aren't you?
You are, and that's why, you see, I say to the students that I teach now, most of you will get the opportunity to become flying instructors of some form or another. Grab it with both hands. Don't see it as a step backwards, because what it will do is it will mature you as an aviator and you will get better. When you, even though you're not touching the stick all the time, just be, we call it sitting in the capacity seat. You know, I'm sitting there, I'm not involved in the nuts and bolts of the flying. And it's easy to sit in the back and just throw darts at how crap people are. But then you get into, well, why are they crap? You know, but how do we stop them being crap on the next trip? That's where all the finesse is in instructing, and it does make you a better pilot. And you're right. I was having been exposed to, you know, both sides of the fast jet fence. Really, I was just very, very lucky. And I always used to say that when we taught students, when they came out of TAC weapons, they were probably the sharpest they were going to be for another 2 years, because they'd then go on to an OCU and be a bit rubbish, you know, trying to learn how to fly that and operate that aeroplane. I think coming out of the TAC weapons as an instructor, I'd got back to, you know, a level of sharpness just for basic flying and operating. Yeah. You'll see there's a bit in the book where I do a bit of frontline support. We used to get asked to go on exercises all the time because we're a tiny little fighter, you know, and we do frontline support. And I did two of them. The first one had an absolute hoot on it, but there was just something in the back of my mind that I thought, God, I think I might have lost a step here. You know, I'm not quite as frontline as I thought I was. And then the second frontline exercise I supported, I was atrocious, you know, from a frontline point of view, because I'd spent two years teaching. And teaching, although they're dynamic exercises, there's not, you know, they're pretty canned. If raging towards each other at 800 knots can be called canned. Yeah, but you see the thing, there was a set kind of framework that we worked within, and I'd lost a bit of that. I'd lost a fair amount of that frontline step, I think, at that point.
The units you were flying to support don't always come out with a great deal of glory.
Ah, no.
In the book either, as people will find. We must mention Detchy again.
Yeah.
You got to go back.
Twice, yeah.
But it's very different, wasn't it?
It was. They sucked all the joy out of it for me. I think it was the biggest disappointment.
I was gutted
of my whole tour. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, yeah. Look at me playing with your emotions with my book. Yeah, yeah. I was. But again, the first time I went back as a student, not part of the squadron fabric, really. So there wasn't anywhere near the camaraderie sort of thing. And the second time I went, I was a fully qualified instructor, but the standards guys that we went with, and CFS guys, mostly weapons instructors again, treated as like students again. And it just, oh God, it really rubbed me up the wrong way. And it took all of the joy out of Dexy. Yeah. Well, it's a confessions book, isn't it, Gareth? You know, yeah. It's pretty stark when it comes to it.
Clues in the title, yeah.
Yeah, we're not pulling any punches.
I must just mention there is a definite progression in Tug Wilson in this book as well. Not just as you go through your career, but your life, and you're definitely a different, slightly different Tug to what you are in the first book, and also you become a family.
Yeah,
having to balance a new arrival with the family with all this incredible amount of flying you're doing, and there's actually a picture in the book. I can't remember exactly what the caption is, but I think it might be like zombie or something.
I think it says zombie. Yeah, I think there's a. Yeah, I'm holding my daughter Holly, and it says proud dad. And underneath, I think it says zombie dad with the other picture, because I look like the death warmed up. Yeah,
and yeah, I guess there is a serious point here. You still had to go to work and fly two or three times the next day, and make decisions as to whether you're, I guess, fit and sharp enough to go and do that. So you've got a whole new set of priorities to balance out as well, haven't you?
Yeah, I mean, you could always spot the guys on the squadron who had new babies, because we looked awful, you know, even before we went flying. That was the that was the thing. But yeah, I mean, it was, but that was the life then. So I came to an accord in the house of how we were going to do it. I had a couple of weeks off, I think, yeah, to get everything sorted, and then started running the household with military precision I bet my daughter didn't know what had hit her at, 2 weeks old, because I had this absolute nailed on program that I'd get up at a certain time, you know, shit, shower, shave, and into making bottles, go to work, fly twice, three times, come back, be dad, do all the feeds and help with the feeds and stuff. I wanted to be a hands-on dad. You know, I'm not one of these old-fashioned, you know, we've had the kids now, introduce them back to me when they're 16 years old and interesting, you know. So I wanted to be hands-on. And so we came to a deal that when it was the feed during the night at 2 o'clock in the morning, I'd go into the spare room, you know, get another 4 hours kip and up at six and do it all again. And it seemed to work. Really, when it came to flying in summer anyway, even if you had a child or not, as instructors, we were generally zombies anyway, because we were flying. We maximized summer at Valley. You just had to. And we were just banging the trips in. There and just having a family was just one extra thing to manage into that program. I make it sound like, get me wrong, having children, most joyous thing that's ever happened in my life, you know. But I've made it sound like it was a routine. It wasn't. It absolutely changed me, and so it should, you know. So it became a bigger priority. It was a bigger priority than flying. But when I climbed into the cockpit, there was nothing else but flying. And that's if you don't take that attitude airborne, then you're not giving the best of yourself, and you're not giving the best to the student as well.
I maybe should have mentioned this earlier as well, with reference to the amount you were flying. These are not benign trips either, are they?
No, they're not. Dear God, no.
These are full on, you know, whatever you're doing, it's pretty full on.
Yeah. I mean, even at, even the low level sorties, where we'd be pulling 4G in the on every turn, every navigation turn, we're pulling 4G. If we're bounced by another fighter, all of the defensive turns are at 4G. Pulling out of the dive on dive attacks, that's at 4G, and it's just cumulative all the way through the trip. Now, to fly for an hour, if you brief and debrief properly and do all the planning properly, you're looking at a 3.5 hour iteration. If we're doing three of those in a day, we're cutting short debriefs in order to brief up the next one. Or I'll come out of one debrief straight into the next trip, but as a wingman, so somebody else is done all the planning and, okay, and is ready to brief it up. So we do a little bit of that. The air combat stuff. If you're doing three air combat trips in a day, we're looking at 6G sustained. What 30 times on every trip, maybe something like that. And but the trips were shorter because the throttle was in the loud corner most of the time.
Yeah.
So thank God the trips were 10 minutes shorter, and it just gave us a bit more time to recover. But yeah, it was hard. I think people underestimate how fatiguing the whole cycle is, not just the flight, but the God, get to winter. Of course, we're putting on immersion suits. Yeah. You know, just getting into the kit was you'd be sweating quarts and knackered just getting in the kit. So,
how much would the students have been flying, Tug?
So we would not. I have seen students flying three times a day, not sustained, because you know it's blowing their minds. But there was a group rule that if a student did have to fly three times in a day, their last trip was not to be solo. There was an incident years ago where a solo student ended up ejecting from a Hawk, a perfectly serviceable Hawk, because I don't think he'd secured the canopy properly or something. But it was his third trip of the day in summer, really hot, you know, and he was just massively fatigued. So that's when that rule came in.
Okay. Well, look, we've got some questions from listeners, but just to wrap this bit up, it's a brilliant read, Tug. There's loads of all this stuff that you and I have been talking about. There's some pretty close shaves in there. I think probably your closest, certainly that I'm aware of, and some stuff that kind of makes the hair on the back of your neck stand up. But it's brilliant. And I said this about Phantom, and I'll say it about this. If you've got any interest in military aviation, you're going to love this. It's another great book, and you know, again, thank you for giving us the opportunity to read all these stories. It's so good that you've put them all down in on paper, and
thanks, Gareth. I do feel as though this one should have come out with a bit of a warning that it's not the outrageous. There is some partying in there and funny stories, but it's not quite the outrageous men behaving badly thing that the previous one was. There were some great stag do's. Let's not go into that.
Everyone's growing up a bit.
But I think the I think the difference with this one is that this book has my most shameful confession in it. Either as an aviator or as a human being, I'm thoroughly and utterly ashamed of one of the stories that's in there, and it would have been so easy to leave it out, but then it's not a confessions book, is it? So, no. So I'm hoping people see the real truthful honesty in this, and it's not just my truth. This is absolutely what happened and how it happened. So, but thanks for the comment.
And actually, before we wrap it up, You said, or this part of it, you said right at the beginning of this interview that you thought there might be some exchange postings that were coming out from people who went and became tactics instructors. And, of course, that became reality for you, because towards the back end of the book, you find out you're only going to go and fly the F-18.
I know. First time in my life a plan has worked out. How brilliant is that? I tell you, I was the most hated man in the Royal Air Force at that point. All of the pilots on the Tornado F3 frontline, I think they loathed me. Most of them had never met me, but you know, I was just that great white Satan who got the blooming exchange tour again from TAC Weapons, you know, and not from the front line. And so, U.S. Marine Corps flying out of the Top Gun hangar at Miramar, flying the best dogfighting aeroplane in the world. And we alluded to it earlier, doing all of the ground attack stuff really did it. I don't know whether it set me up for flying the Hornet, but it stopped me being quite as nervous as I might well have been going to a multi-role aeroplane. The irony is I went to the Hornet and did 80% air-to-air. You know, right. It wasn't such a big step anyway. But what a dream.
So I guess it's not a huge leap of faith to think that Volume 3 will be Confessions of a Hornet Pilot.
That's exactly what it is. Good grief. Yeah, look at you. Yeah, visionary.
Brains of Britain. Right, we have some questions. Actually, we've got a couple of people have submitted. There's a few here. I'm going to ask a couple that are related more to Volume 2, and then we've got a few Phantom questions. Paul Smitty wants to know if creamies are a good idea.
Oh, well, depends what...
To those who don't know what a creamy is.
Yeah, so as we go through flying training, we get our wings when we would normally, as fast jet people, go on to tap weapons. If you were the very best on your course and were really good, there is a chance you might get creamed off and become a creamy, which means you go through central flying school training and become an instructor straight away. And the idea was to have some younger people instructing because I guess they would have more empathy with students, because they'd just been a student themselves. Double-edged sword. I mean, lovely to know that you're the best on your course and the Air Force recognizes that, but you're going to be at least 3 years away from flying a fast jet at the front line. The idea was that if you were a creamy, you could take 3 years away from flying something fast and then go back through the system and they always promised creamies they were going to go Harrier. I mean, we used to laugh our heads off. I mean, when has that ever happened? You know, you'll get your Harrier slot. Now just take 3 years of pain prior to doing that.
We know exactly what's going to be happening in 3 years.
Yeah, exactly. So yeah, it's just one of those things that I would say people fell for. If you got creamed off, you didn't get a choice. You got creamed off. The problem was lots of creamies went back to the Jet Provost and then subsequently the Tucano. So they were slowing down. The creamies that went on to the Hawk, they got a better deal. Do I think it's a good idea? I think for the individual, I don't think it is because they want to achieve and go to the front line. I think for providing a bit more empathy with some of the students, then it is a good idea. But just bear in mind, a creamie has probably never struggled in their life going through training. So there's a bit of a double-edged sword with that as well. God, that wasn't that wasn't a proper answer, was it? Do I think creamies are a good idea? No, I don't. How's that?
Okay.
Yeah.
We might know the answer to this. Paul also asks, what would be your dream instructional airframe?
I think I flew it. I flew the Hawk, not just the airframe, but the job as well. So air combat, low level air defense, ground attack, brilliant. You know, full range of superb trips, and there were very, very few mundane sorties that I flew in the Hawk.
Obviously, T1 is not suitable, not from an airframe point of view, but from an avionics point of view, for putting people in Typhoon and F-35. So, but I guess it's no surprise at all that we just have a slightly different Hawk doing that job now.
Yeah. Do you know what, though? I'd be a bit controversial there. Why isn't T1 and T1A suitable for putting people into a Typhoon? When I flew the T1 and T1A, I mean, we talk about the Phantom being a dinosaur, but people were going from TAC weapons in my day to the Harrier, and that had nav kit in it. So did the Jaguar, so did the Tornado GR1, and the Phantom had nav kit as well, and radar and all that sort of stuff. And you know what? We made the transition, no problem at all. What I worry about is reliance on kit. You should still be able to do mental arithmetic in the air, and there's a measure of capacity as well. Yeah. If you're reliant on kit, you should be backing up with mental dead reckoning and mental arithmetic. Even today, my mental arithmetic is, I still think it's pretty good. It's because I practice it all the time. I spend a lot of time in the car. I do time, distance, speed calculations all the time in the car. It's a lot of fun in the car with me, Gareth, as you can tell. But all I'm trying to do is
wonder your navigators speak so highly.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, no wonder. No wonder I always drive on my own now. Yeah. So I'm just trying to keep my brain active, and a lot of the stuff that we could teach in the Hawk T1 and the T1A meant that your brain was active all the time. Stopwatch, map, and compass. Look, I don't want to go back to the days where there's no kit in aeroplanes, but for training aeroplanes, you need to be able to test the person that you're teaching, and those old piloting, navigating skills are still valid, I think. So it's a little bit controversial to say that, and people will write that comment off as being, oh, he's a dinosaur, he doesn't fly anymore, he's never flown with kit. I flew with kit in the Hornet. I'd never flown with kit before. I still managed to get through the Hornet OCU and do well on the front line there. So, you know, there's an argument to be had for that.
Oh, okay. Kira Murphy, who I know from our Facebook, adored Phantom, has a number of Phantom-related questions for you. Some of these trawling the memory bank.
Yeah, see if I can remember.
But the first one is, he wondered if you ever had a chance to fly or fly in a J79-powered F4, and how did it differ from the Spey engines that we had in the RAF versions?
I didn't. Never managed to. We only had one squadron of F4 Js, and that was 74 Squadron, the Tiger Squadron. So a couple of my mates from my Phantom OCU went to the J model. To tell you the truth, I think I've mentioned this before somewhere, that I think the afterburner lit a bit better at high level. They had a bit more carefree handling on the engines. It looked sleeker, whereas our Phantom had the big fat engines in, looked like it let yourself go a bit, you know, at the back. So we were probably a bit more draggy. Therefore, the J's probably ended up with a higher top end speed, you know, much higher level Mach than us. Oh, I say much higher level, probably only 0.1, 0.2 or something like that. I think the biggest difference was 74 Squadron got to wear American flying suits and American flying kit and, you know, all the fancy helmets with pictures on. But the bottom line is, it's like if you weren't on the Phantom, if you're on the Phantom, every other aeroplane is rubbish. If you're not on 74 Squadron, they just look like posers in their American kit. But I tell you what, I'd have loved to have been on it and worn that kit, you know. So
Did you ever fly against them?
No, the only time I flew against other Phantoms, and
the amazing story about the Hornet.
Oh, we did that last time, didn't we? Yeah, that was the only time I flew against a different mark of Phantom. Yeah,
interesting. Kieran also wanted to know what your typical Phantom speeds would have been for rotation at takeoff and in the circuit and on touchdown as well.
Oh, holy crap. I think this is where we
come on.
I think we get to the limit of my my knowledge here. What would nose wheel be off about? I'd be absolutely bullshitting, Gareth. I really would. Yeah, sorry. I'd love to help you out, Kieran, but there are a ton of proper Phantom books out there. I can tell you how much a pint of Dortmunder was in the bar. That was 10 pence a pint, and gin was tuppence a tot, which is probably why I can't remember any of the speeds in the circuit. Sorry about that.
It's all right. So we've got two more. I think you will be able to answer these. Actually, the first one's an interesting one, which would cross over any aircraft that you've flown, really. The effects of weapons loads, bolting things on the aircraft. How much does that impact on the performance? I guess this is all scalable, isn't it? But sticking an Aiden gun pod on a Hawk must presumably still have an effect.
Yeah. So the gun pod on the center line of the Hawk. Look, if we go to frontline aeroplanes, you can stick 4 Skyflash and 4 Sidewinders on a Phantom, and do you know what? There's a bit of drag. It's the fuel tanks that have the most drag on that. But mostly the jet will just shrug it off, you know, and once it gets airborne, using a little bit more runway and a bit more afterburner, they're pretty sleek when they get above everybody gets about 300 knots. They're all pretty sleek. With the Hawk, I mean, it's tiny. You put the gun pod on, there's a little bit more more drag with that. But because it's on the center line, it seems to fit it quite nicely. And it's shaped, isn't it? The gun pod. But when we flew with sidewinders, we'd have to have them on the pylons and the bomb carriers as well, Seableeds, called. They were immensely draggy. So I think we were adding 10 knots to the on speed for that, and 10 knots on the downwind speed as well. So you just add that 10 knots. It might even be 15 for both sidewinders. Can't quite remember. It was at least 10 though. And you just had to handle it a little bit better. I flew with a student. It was a chop ride, actually. He passed it. But he did just ease into the stall in the finals turn. But he went round straight away. And I said, just add another 5 knots on and you'll be good to go here. And he'd done really well on the trip, and I wasn't going to chop him on that, you know. But a bit more of an issue with the Hawk.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Finally, did you use, we're back to the F4, did you use the brake chute on every landing?
Tried to, yep. Sometimes the SOP was to put the brake chute out on every landing, yeah. And then we'd have, just prior to landing, we'd have a little brief of what we would do if the brake chute failed. And sometimes the jaws in the tail weren't strong enough, and the whole thing had just come out the back and you'd leave it on the end of the runway, which was, a bit annoying. So you'd generally have to bolt. If the runway was a short runway, you'd have to bolt and then burn off gas there. And, that'd be the only time that you'd land without a drag. Oh, if we were going into the cable, of course, we weren't pulling the drag chute.
So actually, just for me to add to that, if you were on a landaway to something like an air show, for example, did you have to repack your own chute, or did you take a packed chute with you, or how does that work?
Okay, the smart pilot, whenever he was going to an air show for a weekend or a weekend away on a Ranger, would have a baggage pod on one of the wings, on one of the pylons, and these were old napalm canisters that had been modded for baggage pods. I would always put a fully packed spare chute in the bag pod. I'd sacrifice a bit of space for my clothes in order to put a spare chute in, because there is nothing more miserable than standing on top of a rickety ladder trying to repack a soaking wet drag chute in the pissing down rain. You get covered in oil and soot and all that sort of stuff. So much better just to put a pre-packed chute in, close the door. The door had a really strong spring on it, to hold it down. So it was hard work anyway. And then you just take that bloody drag chute and shove it in the baggage pod and never see it again until you got home.
That was drinking time. It was take up otherwise, I guess.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Yeah.
Tug, it's been absolutely brilliant once again. It's a pleasure to talk to you. You're clearly so passionate about what you did in your flying career. That comes across. So it's always great to chat. And thank you so much for taking the time to join us once again.
No, not at all. It is a joy to chat about this stuff.
And we do so knowing that there's going to be more to come.
Yeah, you don't get rid of me that easily.
No. Listen, this has only just come, two's only just come out, but is three in progress?
Just started writing. I do have a day job, and I need to kind of make sure I don't get sacked from that. So I've got a bit of a busy period coming up, but as soon as I get that work out of the way, I'll really knuckle down and start writing. And as we said right at the start, the stories come quite easily. So all the finesse is in linking it together and moving things around so they're roughly in the right order. But I'll get on it as soon as I can, Gareth.
Brilliant. Well, I hope Flying Instructor does really well. It certainly deserves to. And I've absolutely no doubt at all that we'll be talking again.
No, I look forward to it. Take care.
Thanks, Tom.
Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website. Please do ask before using anything you hear. The programme's produced with a Creative Commons licence.
Please leave us a review wherever you play your podcast. It genuinely helps grow our programme and broaden its reach. You can also review the programme and leave us feedback on our Facebook page. We'd love to hear from you. If you want to email us, our email address is getinvolved@aviationextended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society is the world's only professional body dedicated to the entire aerospace community. Established in 1866 to further the art, science and engineering of aeronautics, the Society has remained at the forefront of developments in aerospace. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
Extend it!
This is XTP Media.